From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Governor Roy Cooper wants to end future state funding for Opportunity Scholarship School vouchers, but some of his Democratic colleagues in the General Assembly disagree. They're offering all-out support for vouchers and for other forms of school choice. You'll learn why. Some military veterans in the North Carolina General Assembly are pushing a series of bills that would benefit members of the North Carolina National Guard. You'll hear details. The state will submit soon a plan for improving its high school accountability program. You'll learn why the head of a Washington-based education think tank believes this North Carolina plan could lead to significant improvements in the way the state gauges high school success. Plus, we'll learn why small institutional changes in North Carolina's state budget process can have significant impacts that help taxpayers. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Well, they're coming back. The NCAA says basketball, football, soccer, gymnastics, and more will return to North Carolina now that House Bill 2 has been wiped from the books. The ACC also weighing in with a thumbs up. Carolina Journal has been reporting on the many facets of this story for some time now. Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins me now with the very latest. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, I'll ask you again, as I did last time. Everybody happy or anybody happy?
The cities sponsoring the events are happy. the LGBT community remains unhappy. And I think that this sort of process is going to continue, that you're going to see companies that said they were not going to come into the state because of House Bill 2 are going to have to come up with another excuse for not coming into the state, or they're going to come into the state and expand.
Fair to say that there was a lot of pressure being applied by some of the business community around the state to try to get those legislators to repeal House Bill 2, everyone anticipating this, but it was not a lock that the NCAA would come back. And now we also have heard from the ACC.
Right, that's right. The NCAA, all the indications are that behind the scenes there were enough assurances that the NCAA's board would at least consider bids from North Carolina if the legislature was going to go to the trouble of repealing House Bill 2 and all of the collateral damage that happens from getting all the interest groups re-energized and getting all the attention drawn once again to North Carolina for something that people inside the state probably would rather not talk about. So it was fairly certain that something was going to happen. At the very least, the NCAA would consider North Carolina. But yes, now it's coming back, and the ACC announced in middle part of March that its football championship game would be played in Charlotte in December once again. So that's coming. That is coming back again, and that was a fairly rapid announcement right after the NCAA made its announcement.
And that happened just a few days ago. The ACC also weighing in. So is this over? Will we ever hear about House Bill 2 again?
Oh, sure we will. Sure we will. We're going to hear a lot about it. I mean, mid-April also. I've been saying mid-March, but mid-April was when that announcement took place. Yes, we're going to continue hearing about that because we do have ongoing litigation. The Trump administration has said that it is not going to pursue federal lawsuit that was filed on behalf of a transgender teen in Virginia based on Department of Education rules. But that said, there are private suits involved, including one with that student in Virginia. So that's all still alive. The question is if the Trump administration's Department of Education no longer considers gay and lesbian rights to be on a par with other civil rights protections, then are the courts going to view that case as favorably as they would have had the understanding of the Department of Education stayed on the books?
Rick, it's been a very interesting conversation as this has all transpired. Folks on both sides of the issue, and actually I think there were probably more than two sides to the issue. But It led some to really kind of scratch their heads about the role of an organization like the NCAA in trying to dictate public policy. You even had some legislators say, this is really outside their charter and they really shouldn't be doing this and we should do something.
Right. And then that opens up a whole question of the problematic nature of sports operations and nonprofits in attempting to set public policy, because after all, the NCAA and the Atlantic Coast Conference had a lot to do with stripping away the last remnants of Jim Crow when it came to things like integrating basketball teams or integrating football teams. And so they played a very positive role there. And the supporters of the Charlotte Ordinance that led to House Bill 2 said, this is just the next extension in the battle for civil rights. And so if it was okay for the ACC to do that 40 years ago, why is it not okay for the ACC to do that now? And that was the argument that they made. But it's an argument that lends a lot toward the arguments that have been made against abortion rights, for instance, pro or con, is that do you want to have unelected bureaucrats deciding these issues? Do you want to have courts deciding these issues? Or do you want to have the people decide them? I mean, there's a big question about what constitutes unalienable rights and who decides what those are and how they're protected.
Interesting, because as you said, some really cast this as just one more step in the fight for civil rights for a particular group of people. Other people said, well, no, it's not really about that. This is more about economic bullying.
Yes, yes.
Is that argument going to fall by the wayside? Or what happens if we have another organization, whether sports related or not, decide that they want to take on some sort of public policy issue?
Well, if that indeed becomes the method of or the preferred method of protesting particular public policies, there may well be backlash. I mean, the difficulty in this particular issue was that the law that effectively outlawed the Charlotte Ordinance was done in such a hasty fashion and to defeat a deadline that some say was artificial, I think was not. And so because of that, there was no public discussion or very little about it, even though there was a month-long lead-in to it. And so these sorts of things are going to continue. You may well see trade organizations representing different groups or different corporate groups, for instance, opposing public policies based on social policy grounds. And to the extent that that's successful, we'll see. I mean, the various religious groups that have boycotted Target because it has openly announced that it will allow. Persons to go to the restroom of the gender with which they identify, they suffered a big hit in sales this past year. And religious groups that opposed or that supported House Bill 2 are taking credit for it. But still, those sorts of things, the marketplace has a way of working these things out, if you will. The challenge with a group like the NCAA is that they are effectively a monopoly. And they also have tax-exempt status. So that's different than, let's say, a single organization, a particular religious organization, or some sort of private entity that's not a monopoly, announcing a boycott or saying don't buy products from this merchant or that merchant. It's completely different when you say, if you don't follow things the way that we want them to go, then we're going to pull our events from you. And that's a much more catastrophic and definitive kind of thing.
It's kind of a question of it's one thing if you have choices. And
right.
You have one organization among a dozen
who yes.
wants to take a particular stand, then you as a consumer can choose, yes, I agree, or no, I don't agree. But when it's that monopoly, it's a little bit different. Also, interesting politics, I think, to this. Got to be wondering, the one person I'd like to talk to right now, frankly, former Governor Pat McCrory,
mm-hmm.
and what he thinks about how this has all transpired. There's an argument to be made that at least in part, it's the reason that he was not reelected. He signed it.
Right. And he's come out and said that he's very glad that it's gone, that he's happy that House Bill 2 no longer is on the books simply because it is something that became an issue that was actually a mythical sort of status that made it larger than the actual controversy at hand. And so all people had to do was say House Bill 2, and it didn't matter what was in it. Well, North Carolina did House Bill 2. It's a bad state. Therefore, we should stay away from it. And you still see, to this day, you see cities and states limiting the travel of their employees to North Carolina because they don't think that House Bill 2 really was repealed. There's a potential controversy, I do believe, with the University of California playing a football game at Duke this year. I mean, there's still things like that that are out there, and these little brush fires are going to continue for a while.
And questions, of course, over what power do cities and counties actually have as opposed to state government.
Yes.
And that gets into a very interesting discussion about the Constitution and who is allowed to do what. And a lot of people didn't agree and didn't care.
That's right. Home rule, no home rule, Dillon rule. It's very complicated, but I guess these debates continue.
And of course, Carolina Journal will be reporting on every remaining facet of this story of House Bill 2. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He, of course, is editor-in-chief. You can read all of his work at CarolinaJournal.com. Follow him on Twitter.
At Deregulator.
All right, Rick Henderson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governor Roy Cooper wants to stop state funding for opportunity scholarships. They offer private school vouchers to low-income families. But some of Cooper's Democratic Party colleagues disagree. A group of African American state lawmakers recently spoke out in favor of vouchers and other forms of school choice. Mecklenburg County Representative Rodney Moore led the discussion.
We stand here today joining our voices for a simple yet powerful statement. We are here to extend our support for educational options for all North Carolina families and students. We stand today to be a voice for the voiceless. Far too often, families and children are left out of the education decision-making process. With that, our support for educational options for all North Carolinians includes parental school choice as a complement to our unwavering support for quality educational institutions across our state, including traditional public schools, public charter schools, private schools, and home schools. Make no mistake, the bedrock of strong community starts with our schools. And we are here to ensure that every child, let me reiterate, every child receives the best education possible, regardless of his or her zip code or family income. As supporters of education, we stand for North Carolina's 1.5 million students enrolled in public schools and the approximately 100,000 public school teachers who serve to educate those students every day across our state. We must do more for our public schools, and we stand committed to do just that.
Moore says support for education goes beyond traditional district schools.
As supporters of education, we stand for North Carolina's public charter schools, especially those with the mission of providing educational programs aimed at serving socioeconomically disadvantaged students across our state, where we see more growth for these kinds of public schools in the 40 counties that still don't have them. As supporters of education, we stand for North Carolina's Children with Disability Scholarships grants, where families whose child qualifies under this private school program will be provided the resources to find the educational needs that fit them. As supporters of education, we stand for North Carolina's Opportunity Scholarship Program, which is providing educational options to nearly 6,000 low-income families. This coalition understands that in North Carolina, you cannot talk about education and education reform without talking about race and politics. It is our hope that by uniting together in support of education for all and for all quality education models, that we begin to bridge the gap that has far too often hindered us. Black versus white students, Democrat versus Republican, and traditional schools versus non-traditional schools. We have come too far and tackled too many challenges to leave a generation of children behind. Today, together, we stand for these children, and we will fight for them by any means educationally.
Representative Ed Haynes of Forsyth County explained his support for school choice.
It is the issue of opportunity. And I think that is what we are talking about and what we're most focused on when we look at our kids. It's the opportunity. It's the same. We want our children to have the same opportunity that many of our parents afforded us when we were growing up in the public schools of North Carolina. As I think about those opportunities, my parents had me attending schools all over the district in order to get into the right school, the right public school to fit me. And to fit my skill set and to fit what I needed to grow as a young man. And we were successful doing that. What we have right now, and especially in my district in Winston-Salem, is a city that has largely resegregated itself in our public schools. We have 99% free and reduced lunch schools, not that are 99% black and Latino. That is what our elementary schools mostly look like. In my district, there are a couple that don't look like that. Of those 99% free and reduced lunch schools, they have third grade reading proficiency rates that are in the name of, they're at the range of 11%, 14%, 22%, and one that I visited last week that's around 7 or 8%. I didn't say the average age of the child at the school was 8 years old. I said their third grade reading proficiency is 8%. I want you to let that resonate with you for a second. That is a 92% fail rate. I cannot in good conscience look at any mother or father and tell them that they should be satisfied with that. None of us would invest our money with a broker who had a 92% fail rate. It would not happen.
Senator Erica Smith Ingram also added her voice to those supporting school choice.
I stand here today to support parents having a choice in educating their children. I stand today as a parent who did not produce cookie-cutter children despite sharing the same DNA and the same genetical coding. I believe, as Miles Monroe once shared, there's a reason why McDonald's can set up shop right beside Hardee's, across the street from Burger King, down the corner from Wendy's or Bojangles. You ever wonder why those companies, same entities, can set up shop right beside each other? It's because of free market and offering choice. I believe that we should have that same choice and same free market in education. I stand today as a parent whose eldest child graduated from Kip Pride High, GCP Charter School in Northampton County. I stand here today as a parent whose younger child did phenomenally well in the traditional public school. I stand today as a public school educator, knowing that we cannot talk about education without being able to reiterate the importance of parents having choice, parents having opportunity, parents having the resources they need to provide the educational environment for their children that is most conducive to their success.
Senator Ben Clark of Hoke County addressed popular myths about school choice.
As far as I'm concerned, the expenditure of public funds for a public cause is always a good thing. I can think of no greater cause than educating our children. We often hear folks say that I don't want my public dollars going to private schools. But what they fail to understand is those public dollars are going to educate children who are part of our citizenry. So again, the expenditure of public funds for a public cause is a great thing. And I can think of no greater cause than education of our children. I believe that our toolkit of educational opportunities for our children should not be latched with unnecessary restraints, and it must be populated with a variety of options. We've heard our members here. Most of them have maybe attended public schools, private schools, home schools, charter schools. But oftentimes what we see in our society is that those of us who have or were privileged to come from homes where we had the means, we had those options. More often than not, what happens in our society is that those who are challenged in terms of means are those are the ones that do not have the opportunity. Those are the ones that do not have the choice. And I believe it is incumbent upon us to make sure that those who come from homes where the means are challenged also have a choice.
That's State Senator Ben Clark, one of several African-American Democratic lawmakers speaking up in favor of school choice. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Lawmakers have filed a series of bills designed to help members of the North Carolina National Guard. Democratic Representative Greer Martin explains.
The first legislation is a bill that addresses the issue of our service members returning home, and as a result of their experiences, they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And as a result of that, unfortunately, that can result sometimes in interaction with our legal system. This bill would merely say that if you are found guilty of a crime, that when you're sentenced, the judge can choose to consider as a mitigating factor that you incurred PTSD as a result of your military service. This is patterned after a law passed in the state of Oklahoma that they found to be very successful.
That's one of just seven bills Martin and fellow military veterans are pushing in the state House and Senate.
We also have several bills that deal with the issue of the difference in duty status between a member of the reserve component that's called to federal active duty, working for the president, perhaps to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan, and a member of the North Carolina National Guard who could be called to federal active duty, working for the president at war, or instead called to state active duty, working for the governor to fight forest fires, floods, etc. There are significant protections in federal law right now for folks called to federal active duty, but they don't exist as much when you're called to state active duty. So we've got some bills here that would help address that disparity. It would also enable the state attorney general to play a role in enforcing our service members' rights. Oftentimes, a 19-year-old soldier, their only recourse, even though they've got protections of law, would be to hire a lawyer. This would allow, if enough complaints were out there in a problem, that the attorney general could get involved. We also are addressing the issue of National Guardsmen who are also students in our community colleges and our public university systems, who are called to active duty to protect us from disasters or other emergencies, to ensure that when they come back to class, that they won't suffer for their service to our communities. We've also got a bill that would ensure that the tuition assistance money that we provide the National Guard to help National Guardsmen with their educational tuition, that can be applied to professional certifications, such as Microsoft certifications, to enable our North Carolina National Guardsmen to compete for jobs in our 21st century economy.
Republican Senator Danny Earl Britt is working with Martin.
I see that what we can do could be great work to support those soldiers that are out there that are doing above and beyond what they signed up for whenever they originally signed up as National Guard soldiers. Several of these soldiers are serving as much time as what our active duty soldiers have in the last 10 to 15 years with the current environment that we've had with Iraq and Afghanistan and still being in Kuwait, many of our soldiers. So I'm honored to be able to be here in Raleigh to be able to help work on some of this important legislation that I think is going to provide such a wonderful benefit to all our members of the National Guard.
You've been listening to discussion about a series of bills designed to help members of North Carolina's National Guard. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has a chance to overhaul its accountability system for public high schools. What form should that reform take? Michael Petrilli, president of a Washington, D.C.-based education think tank, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, has some ideas, and he joins us now to discuss them. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Mitch.
So this is something that is going to be very important for North Carolina's public school systems, isn't it, to having some sort of reform of the way that high schools are held accountable.
That's right, Mitch. So North Carolina has had an accountability system for decades now, and there are some good things about that system. I like that it is an A to F system, meaning that schools get graded A, B, C, D, F. That's much better than what you see in some other states where the ratings that states give schools are almost Orwellian. You can't tell if by the label if the school is great or if it's terrible.
But, in fact, North Carolina has recently changed to that A to F. We used to have the outstanding schools or schools of excellence or schools of distinction, and you didn't know what that meant. So that sounds like other states are still doing that sort of thing.
That's right. That's right. Thankfully, now about a dozen states have the A to F system, and it's much better. So that part is worth keeping. North Carolina has to update its accountability system because there's a new federal law that went into that came into being about a year ago, the Every Student Succeeds Act. Under that law, the states still have to test students regularly and they still have to grade schools. But there's more flexibility in how they do that. North Carolina right now is looking at its accountability system and trying to decide what it should look like going forward. I do hope it keeps the A to F system, but much else about that system needs to change, especially for high schools. And the problem is, under No Child Left Behind, so much of the focus was on getting kids to this level that we called proficiency, meaning basic proficiency in reading and math. Well, that had this negative outcome, which was to encourage schools to pay all of their attention to just getting kids to that one level. At the time, it was a pretty basic level, and so it meant that if you were, you know, a high-achieving student, you were going to reach that on the test no matter what. You probably could have reached that on the first day of school. And so schools were not encouraged to pay much attention to those kids. Now, the standards have been raised. The tests are harder than they used to be. But still, those high-achieving kids are going to meet that without any problem. So it's our view that what states need to do is make it clear that every kid matters, that schools need to pay attention to helping every child make progress over the course of the year. So one thing we hope North Carolina will do is to measure achievement not just at proficient, but also at the advanced level, and give schools some kind of recognition or reward for getting more kids to that advanced level. The other thing that's important is to look at how much progress kids are making over time. You know, a high school has no control over where kids are when they come in the ninth grade. You know, there might be some schools where kids are reading at a fifth or sixth grade level or doing math at a fifth or sixth grade level. And a high school, all they can control is how much progress the kids make once they are under their charge. And so it is really much more fair to look at that rate of progress over time than to look at the kids' single test scores. North Carolina has a way to do that, something called value added that's been in place for a long time, calculated by the company here in North Carolina, SAS, and it's quite good. The problem is, at least in the past, that value added score hasn't counted for much. And so as a result, most of the focus in North Carolina still has been on getting everybody to the proficient level, not a lot of focus on kids making progress over time or getting to that advanced level. So all that to be said, this is a chance for North Carolina to step back and to rethink its system and to make sure that it's aiming high enough. One last thing, Mitch, is that what some other states have done that North Carolina should do is also look at whether kids are getting access to advanced placement courses and to other opportunities to earn college credit while still in high school, and reward schools when kids do indeed get that kind of college credit. We know that kids that do that are much more likely to go to college, succeed in college. It's another way to indicate that high levels of achievement, that excellence, are something that are valued here, that we're getting away from the No Child Left Behind days of just focusing on basic skills and moving much more into getting kids college ready.
That is the voice of Michael Petrilli, president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about high school accountability measures in North Carolina. How important is this? I mean, some people might hear this and say, well, it sounds like, you know, shuffling the deck chairs around. You're going to grade this way instead of grading that way. Is it really going to make a difference? If they do accountability right, will the North Carolina school officials be making a real difference for students?
No, it's a good question, Mitch. I mean, look, this is not as important as the meat and potatoes of actually improving teaching and learning in the classroom, okay? But in terms of what states can do, I think it is important in terms of the signals we send to schools about what we value. And here's what else is important. For schools out there that are at risk of being labeled a failing school, okay, this is going to make a big difference about how we measure these things. Under the current system, it is very likely that any school in North Carolina that serves lots of poor kids who tend to come into high school, you know, many grade levels behind, the current system is going to end up labeling most of those schools a D or an F. And that's demoralizing for the people working in those schools, no matter how great they do, no matter how much progress kids make. Because so many kids aren't going to reach the proficient level on state tests, they're going to look bad. If you change the system so that those schools have a chance of earning an A also, if they help kids who come in far behind make a ton of progress while they're in high school and reach those higher standards, and you can get rewarded for that, I think that makes a big difference in those schools. This may not have a big impact on the schools out there in the affluent suburbs of Raleigh and Charlotte and other places, you know, schools that are going to probably do okay under any system. But for the schools that are at risk of being labeled failing schools, this could matter a lot.
It sounds as if this also could have an impact, a positive impact,
when we see that, you know, the teaching toward the test, if you're actually aiming toward meeting these goals and they are the right goals, then it'll be better than just trying to make everyone at least average and not pay attention to the high achievers.
That's exactly right, Mitch. That what we see in our schools in a lot of places is that these test scores and these accountability systems do drive teaching and learning. And in the past, under No Child Left Behind, this previous federal law, unfortunately, we saw some schools that were teaching in a very low-level way. You know, they were having kids do a lot of fill-in-the-blank and multiple choice and the kind of writing that none of us would want to see for our own kids because they were getting kids ready for these tests. Well, you know, now we have tougher standards. We have tougher tests. And now if we send the signal to schools that you've got to actually get kids to this much higher level where they can write well, where they can reason, where they can do really tough math problems, where they can, you know, think critically, then that's going to encourage much better kind of teaching in the classroom.
Is it difficult to make the changes that you're talking about, or is this something that North Carolina could put together pretty easily?
Frankly, it's not hard. I mean, they have this great opportunity under because they have to make some changes because of this new federal law. The State Department of Education is working on a draft plan and getting input. I suspect the legislature may get involved. It certainly has been the case in some states. It doesn't take much, and there are some states that are doing all of these things that I've talked about. You know, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, we do a lot of work on the ground in Ohio. Ohio does all the things already that I'm talking about, and its system is pretty good. North Carolina could simply look to Ohio's and copy much of it. And there are other states around the country that are doing these things also.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting topic. We know that one person who's going to be following it very closely is Michael Petrilli. He is president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, an education think tank based in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. How will North Carolina spend the money that we've all paid in taxes and fees? Well, that, of course, is the question being debated in the General Assembly right now as lawmakers put together a new state operating budget for the year that starts on July 1st. But legislators are also looking at ways to make changes to the actual budgeting process, all with the goal in mind of putting North Carolina on sounder financial ground beyond just one budget. Joe Coletti has been looking at this, writing about it. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Nice to talk with you. So you've been writing about this, and you've laid out several different things that you say have bipartisan support in the legislature and really would be good for North Carolina. Let's start first with your thoughts about the Rainy Day Fund. What is it, and why is it a good thing?
The Rainy Day Fund is technically called the Savings Reserve Account. It was created about 1991, and it's a place where, as we talk about Savings Reserve or Rainy Day Fund, the legislature puts money aside for when saves money for a rainy day when things go bad in the economy and tax revenues don't come in as expected or as hoped. And so North Carolina has had one, as I said, since 1991, and it's never really been funded that well. The most that it had in it was about 5% of general fund spending. And research suggests that it should be closer to 13 to 18%. And so the legislature this year, unanimously in the Senate, I think two people voted against it in the House, Governor Cooper signed it, said we need to expand this rainy day fund, the savings reserve account, and have the budget director decide how much should be in this fund and sets up some automatic deposits to it. So it really strengthens it, and so that the next time that we have a recession, we should be in much better financial shape as a state.
So it sounds like if only a couple of people voted against this, this is one of those examples we rarely hear about,
That's
but
right.
which do actually occur in the legislature, where Democrats and Republicans can agree on a pretty serious principle, one that we all try to practice. We try, at least, in our own personal finances to have something set aside so that something bad happens, it doesn't kill you, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so rainy day fund is one of those things, but then you've also been writing about the fact that there's some agreement in the legislature over session limits. Yeah. Tell us what that is and why you think that would be good for North Carolina.
Session limits, people are more familiar with term limits, which says you can only be in the legislature so many times and be elected and reelected. Session limits focus on how long the legislature meets during a year. And so there are two bills. First one is bipartisan introduction in the Senate from Senator Chaudhary and from Senator Tillman that sets a calendar day limit on the amount of time that the legislature can meet. On the House side, Representative Dollar has introduced a bill that would create a constitutional amendment, so we would all get a chance to vote on this, that says the legislature has to wrap up all its business by June 30th. And from research that's been done on session limits, shorter sessions lead to less chance for shenanigans among legislators, and so that's generally where the positive comes from, is that there's less time for them to come in and say, oh well, why don't we try this and add additional spending items to the budget.
And after all, in North Carolina, as in some other states, this is supposed to be a part-time citizen legislature, right?
Yeah, and they do generally a good job of that, and so but having a formal limit has worked in other states, and so that's why it's a good idea here.
A deadline. They'd be coming in with a deadline. Get the job done and then go back home.
Yes.
Okay. Budgeting also, Joe, sometimes we focus a lot on the fact that, for example, they're putting together a budget for the next fiscal year that starts July 1st. But you're saying that folks really need to be looking further out, do some forecasting, and in fact, there's some support for that.
Yeah. And this is to provide five-year forecasts for the entire budget. For a lot of spending bills, the Fiscal Research Division of the General Assembly, the full-time staff, will put together five-year forecasts for an individual bill, whether that's a spending bill or a tax bill, to say what will happen if we do this. A couple of years ago, the Office of State Budget and Management, which is the governor's side of the budget debate, and his full-time staff, added a five-year forecast on the revenue side and on the spending side to take a look at what are the implications for the way that we've set up spending and the way that we've set up taxation. And Senator Chaudhary, again, has sponsored a bill that would require this for on both the legislative side and on the governor's side, a five-year forecast for the entire budget.
So really, it would be saying to legislators as well as the governor's office then, everybody, you need to be looking at the long-term impact of what you are proposing for the next several years.
Right.
So that certainly is a good idea. And interestingly enough, Joe, right now as we're having this debate over the next operating budget, this idea of a five-year forecast has become pretty interesting because we have some disagreements over the potential impact of a proposal from the Senate on tax cuts and tax reform.
Yeah. So the Senate has a bill out that is called the $1 billion middle-class tax cut. And Fiscal Research went through and attached a fiscal note to that, one of those five-year fiscal notes that we talked about earlier. And showed how much that would reduce tax revenues coming into the state over the next 5 years. And they call it a $1 billion tax cut because within the first 2 years, it's about $1 billion. And it's about $700 million each year after that. And a legislator asked Fiscal Research to take another look at that combined with the savings reserve account, the HB7 that we talked about earlier, where we automatically are setting aside money in the savings mm-hmm. reserve, the rainy day fund, and then took a look at what happens with spending. And using the forecast of we have these programs in place and spending will to do all the same things the same way with more people, spending will increase over time. And so when fiscal research took a look at that, they said, yeah, this would lead to large deficits, $600 million or more in three of the next 5 years. We went back and took a look at it and said, well, the Senate's actually been – the legislature's been pretty prudent with how they've been spending money. Spending the last 2 years has only grown about 2.6% each year. So we said, let's take a look at it, what would happen if we continued that on. And you run into 1 year, you have a shortfall. But for the next 5 years, by the fifth year, you end up with, instead of a $600 million shortfall, you have an $800 million surplus. So that's where the five-year forecast is useful, because you have to take a look at these things. But it becomes really important to understand what the assumptions are that go into those.
Yeah, it's a great example of how this really isn't just technical talk right. or theory. This five-year forecast really can inform the debate right. of decisions being made today that will impact every North Carolinian yeah. down the road for several years to come. Well, we've been talking with Joe Coletti. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. If you're interested in finding out more about his analysis of budgeting and spending, you can find it all at johnlocke.org. Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.